Welcome to this latest in our series of interviews with leading fundraising research and insight professionals. I'm joined this week by Marianne Pelletier. Welcome, Marianne.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. We're just going to go through a few questions around using quantitative methods to support advancement in fundraising and talk about your experience and also the experience of working in fundraising insight in the US as opposed to working in the UK over here. So maybe we can just kick off by, if you want to say a few words about how you got into the area to begin with, Marianne, that'd be really helpful.
Sure. So I was running an annual fund back in 1999, and I was in my MBA program, and I was excited at the idea in quantitative analysis about how we can actually predict what sales would be. At that time, Peter Wiley came out with his article in Case Currents called Model Behavior.
Yeah.
And I got very excited. My assistant was also in the MBA program, and so the two of us actually built a model on donor acquisition and donor renewal and upgrade for our annual fund. Yeah.
We saw
an average, over 5 years, we saw an average of 27% increase in fundraising results each year.
Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah, using this method. Yeah. So, of course, I had to make presentations, and then I found myself as a software consultant for the Datatel Corporation doing data management and some analytics, and It's been exciting ever since.
Wow. So when did you move into advancement? You see, you started off on the private side and then moved across to nonprofits. When was that? When did that happen?
So my career started in nonprofits back in 88 when I was at Harvard, and I joined the development office to run their library. And part of that job was to do prospect research, and I fell in love with it.
So the
software consulting piece was actually 3 years away from nonprofits, and then I came back into nonprofits when I joined the staff at Carnegie Mellon.
I see. So what's and who in your? So you're currently at Cornell, that's right.
Yes.
So what departments do you work with the most at Cornell? Who are the main groups of people that you would interact with, kind of going along with your role?
Right. So the deal with analytics is that it can be used to solve a variety of problems, and so the question we're all working with the most right now is engagement and donor participation.
Mm-hmm.
Cornell is judged against all of the other schools in the United States and even internationally by alumni participation in giving to the annual fund.
Yes.
So last year, my focus was helping the annual fund find the right people to approach to keep participation up.
Uh-huh.
This year, I'm working closely with the Alumni Relations Office or Alumni Affairs to look at how to manage your engagement, what engagement really looks like, and what an engaged person looks like when they're about to become a donor.
Sure. So that's kind of profiling and understanding what are the touch points with the organization, I guess, to be aware of, to actually understand who are the most engaged supporters.
Yes. And so we're looking at, not only are we looking at the movement of someone through graduation into some engagement position, but we're also looking at We got survey results. We asked our alumni how they felt about Cornell, and we've been digging through those results as well. So it's not only a snapshot of a person that looks like someone we should engage, but also what do you look like, say, if you were a Cornell alumnus, what would you look like at a point when you were ready to say, I'm ready to step into the role of something?
Yeah, so really putting yourself, well, putting the organization and internalizing that kind of experience and that information and learning the lessons from that, I guess, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, and as you said, what do we do to help encourage that engagement forward? Yes.
Yeah, sure. So you would work with alumni relations. Do you work?
Yeah.
Would you work with kind of people at more senior levels throughout the organization to kind of get those messages across and really communicate those findings, or is it?
Well, yeah. So Cornell is a very person-to-person kind of organization. We had David Dunlop create our culture here,
sure.
And so to walk to a gift officer and say this kind of person is most likely to make a larger gift.
Sure.
That's a culture shift for the organization.
Yeah.
So when I was director of research, I had access to the program directors to make presentations on, you know, what we see and how, why we chose the people that we chose to put into the pool.
Sure.
The position I'm in now, it's my supervisor who actually brings our information forward. Okay. And there's a team of seven of us who work not just on analytics. There's a team of seven of us who work on reporting, dashboarding, the system understand that managing the database and managing regular reporting, but also analytical reporting in the dashboard. Mm. And so it's my boss that usually sits in front of the trustees or the vice president and the senior leadership team to talk about what we see.
So you've got a team of seven, and that's split. Are there specialists there in the different areas? So do you have a specialist for dashboards, routine reporting, specialized reporting, bespoke projects? Or?
Well, there is some crossover, but we do have one person who's primarily responsible for gift reporting, so that he can be counted on to be able to answer questions that usually get asked. And we do have one person who's responsible for most of the report writing in our legacy system, because that's her expertise.
Sure.
And I'm the only one who's doing analytics full-time. However, I do have a colleague who's been doing some web scraping to do prospecting.
Sure.
And that's been brilliant as well.
Okay.
And so for us, it's figuring out what the university needs, what the organization needs at this point in our campaign and at this point in our economy, you know, and trying to fill information where we didn't have it before.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, I mean, I was at a conference recently, and the point was made by the head of analytics for quite a major retailer here in the UK. So the question was about skills, basically. And so what type of skills do you need to move into analytics? And he actually said that the three C's, as he put it, so communication, curiosity, and I think he said common sense as well, but these three quite intuitive skills were really imperative. And actually the technical side of things could come on top of that, but without these three qualities, it's not possible to be an analyst. So I wondered, do you agree with that? And is that your experience?
It is my experience. And actually in finding prospects, curiosity is required. If you follow the same routine all the time to find prospects, you're going to find the same sorts of prospects, and you'll never dig around in the other minefields or gold fields or whatever expression we'd want to use.
Sure.
And so I have to have a lot of curiosity to have the patience to repeat a model and to go back and rebuild different kinds of data, repeat the model again, go back and build different kinds of data.
Yeah.
The communication piece comes in when I have a result and I'm very excited about it, but my result is expressed in the form of an equation and expressed in the form of R squared and here. And I have to translate that to convince someone who's accustomed to talking to people the way you and I are talking now.
Yeah, sure.
They don't see numbers on your face. So the communication piece is understanding how to build the graphics and how to build the illustration and tell the story in a way that people will say, okay, I'll try it.
And how did you start off with that skill set to communicate your results, or have you had to learn that over time? Because that's, for me, I would have thought that that's kind of two separate skill sets. You've got the analytical side, numbers, quantitative stuff, but then you've also got the softer skills of being able to actually explain your ideas, communicate, get people on side. You know,
I did actually have to learn how to build enthusiasm, and where I am right now, my supervisor, Bruce Higgins, has worked really hard with me on making illustrations that are clear and easy for a person to understand and pick up. Mm. I'm used to telling the story verbally and getting people enthusiastic that way. But the stuff we're trying to do now is going to take real data that people can see, put their hands on, and watch the patterns.
Yeah.
So that's been what in the position I'm in now, I've been in this position for 2 years, that's really been most of the learning curve that I've been on.
And how have you found that when you're explaining ideas within your organization? Has it been a challenge for you to get these ideas across? Things that are very exciting, as you say, the findings quite often. Have you found that a challenge to get that across, or has it been sort of, have people been
accepted? It's a challenge. So the catch is that in nonprofits, nobody wants you to change their habits. So so the catch is that the audience will either say, well, we already knew that. You spent all this time to prove what we already knew.
Sure.
Or you're showing us something we've never seen before, so we don't trust it. And so I've often talked about the rock and the hard place. You have to pick one. You either have to say, it's okay for me to validate what we've already been doing, or you have to say, it's okay for me to show you something new.
Yeah.
And then after a huge study, when we come up with five bullet points that I think would double, you know, our returns one way or another, it's still, well, you only came up with five bullet points.
Yeah.
And so, and that's inertia. That's simply inertia, and there has to be culture change, that's all. And so my sense of persistence that I bring to the job is part of the piece that helps. And I have to educate so it's my supervisor who goes forward with my information. I have to educate him too. He's a data man. He's not an analytics man. So to take him from the, this is how many alumni we have, to this is, you know, the this actual pattern slightly illustrates the likelihood of someone. It's so far from absolute that it's, it causes discomfort.
And that's one of the key things. So there was this book out recently by Kevin McDonald and Peter Wiley called Score. And if you read through that book, it's interesting how much of it is about what you just talked about, actually. So how much of it is about educating others and communicating results and the human processes behind the analysis, really, and, you know, these types of things. And what it is is a toolkit, or it's designed to be a toolkit, to enable people to go and sell these ideas, really, and change the way their organizations work. So have you, how have you found that work? Has that been a useful piece for you to be aware of? And how have you found it?
Yes, and so just like, so when in prospect research, and tell me if I'm answering your question, in prospect research, we always were trying to convince gift officers to accept the prospects that we found. And that was the contest. It was, and the gift officers would come back and say, you're not giving us the right prospect. It was always the contest. And so in analytics, it was, you're not answering the question that we had. Well, and or you're telling us something we already know. And so there's a great deal of persuasion and persistence and demonstration. However, once I have, I did the model where I demonstrated the kind of people who would be most likely to renew giving or be loyal annual fund donors. When the year was over, we checked to see how the model did, and it did great.
Right.
And so as soon as it worked, then people were willing to, much more willing to adopt it. Sure. And we've implemented another model again this year.
That's great. So, I mean, success will speak for itself, I guess. So when you're working on a new project, or when you're refining a past project, do you find yourself having to just, as you said, be persistent and just re-explain the idea maybe a few times? I guess it's a rare project where people just jump on it and just take it first time. I guess you find yourself having to re-explain and be persistent, as you said.
Well, and even in the 90s, we dealt with this, the same, people felt the same way about screening results. They would get a screening result back. They would look six people down the list, and they would say, I already know that person would never give to us, so this whole thing is wrong. You know? So, you know, tyranny of the exception. So, yes, there is a considerable amount of persistence and persuasion. Yeah. But they haven't removed my position, so sure. I must be offering something, you know?
I'm sure you're offering a great deal, that's the thing. So, I mean, that's really interesting to me. So, I mean, the one of the sort of topics, and you've touched on it before, that is really interesting in the UK at the minute, is about building the stronger relationships. So not just acquiring supporters or marketing to new supporters, but also building relationships and making them more deep with supporters. Is that something that you're aware of as a trend kind of in your area? Is that something that's important in your work at the minute?
So when you're talking about building relationships, do you mean between you and your internal clients, or do you mean between the organization and the prospects?
So that would be between the organization and the prospect. So
Yes, because the engagement question that I've been struggling with is really all about understanding what is it that would make someone feel more affection for Cornell than, say, some local charity that already is right there and already has a Facebook page and what have you. I'm sorry, I'm speaking to you from home, so the cats want to know what's going on.
That's fine. I can see he's interested.
So if you think about, if you go through your day and try to count how many times you're bombarded with something wanting your attention, it's much bigger than it was, you know, in the 1970s when I was a kid.
Absolutely.
So, and even your email, there's nothing novel anymore where if you receive it, it's very exciting. Even texts, if I sent a text saying, please give to Cornell, that's one of 10 or 11 texts I'll get in a day.
Right.
So understanding the relationship and building the relationship and then speaking to people, Amazon kind of spoiled it for us, because when I get on Amazon.com, it tells me, you know, welcome back, and here's some things we have for you, and it makes me feel very comfortable and very well served, as though I'm in a nice restaurant. And So any organization that wants to reach out to someone has to be that personable and understand that person very well.
But this is a bit, it strikes me that this is a bit, a slight nightmare here, because we've got all these different ways that people can interact with organizations. And the classical way that an organization, nonprofit or commercial, has understood their relationship with their constituency is through a journey kind of thing. So like a customer journey, a supporter journey, something like this. But this journey is tricky now, because there are all these touch points, and it's really difficult to know actually, and actually map out how people are interacting with you. So are you finding that working for a big organization in the US, is this a similar challenge there?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. Any number of things can take our precious Bilbo Baggins off the path to the to the big ring, you know? So yes, absolutely. And the piece is that we, I have often wondered if we're also getting into a place where we start nesting. So I can work from home, I can talk to you from home, which means I can be home with my children. And Generation X is a generation that was latchkey kids. All the both the parents worked. So they're very protective and involved with their kids to make up for that. So when I think about what we're talking about right now, I think about things like you can't have a reunion without offering babysitting services, without offering something for the family, because people will want to be with their families.
Interesting.
And if you want someone to give to Cornell, it has to have something to do with them and their lives right now.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. I think there's probably, you'll have seen, there was a story, I think last year, though, touching on analytics, and I think the point that you're making about being on the edge of getting too much insight, right? So this was about Target, the retailer, and sort of predicting, using their sort of quantitative methods to predict that somebody was pregnant, and they sent her a mailing, and in fact she was pregnant, but she hadn't seen, she hadn't told her family, and her dad picked up the letter, and this kind of set off a conversation about how much insight is too much, right? Because it's big data and all that stuff. So actually what you're saying is quite interesting, because people are, they've got their habits and they want organizations to come to them, but not too much, right?
Right. So it has to not feel like my privacy has been invaded.
Right, exactly. So that's a bit of a challenge for the analyst, I think, in that case. But does Cornell try to engage? How is it tracking the supporter journey, I guess, is my question. Mm-hmm. Is that integrated?
And that's the piece that we're trying to build right now. So we were the first university to hire a full-time social media person.
Oh.
And he has a staff now. If you can imagine a staff of people whose job is to monitor and to build social media excitement. Mm-hmm. And so they started with just they were using Meltwater now, I think they're using Sprout, but just getting information and trying to hand connect that to our records to see what people are saying.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
And that's what, so I have a colleague who actually did a lot of the matching algorithms, the programming, so that we don't have a person being paid full time to sit there and look someone up.
Sure. Does this touch on your role as well? Is that coming through to analysis and analytics?
So that would be the next step if we can figure out how to move that. And so we've already started talking about that. We have a project that we're working on where we actually take, we had people who were Cornellians played a game on Facebook.
Right.
And they gave us their names and their class years. So we took that information. We're going to try to append their data to it and run it through a product called NodeXL.
Yes, so this is network mapping software.
And see who the mavens are. I don't know if you remember the book The Tipping Point, where the maven is the person that connects people to other people.
Yes.
Yeah. We want to see who those people are and who the power influencers are, and then see who the larger donors are, see who the most engaged people are, and how connected they are into the network.
That's interesting. So you would use those maps to just identify the hub, kind of the hubs in those, or the nodes in those networks.
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Okay. And that would be, wow. But that's using software, I'm assuming, to kind of scrape through web content and then bring that back into the system there to do a lot of the legwork for.
Well, the Facebook game, they agreed to give us their name and class year. So Facebook took care of giving us that information. But if you think about it, so we were talking about, you know, how can we be connected to people without looking like we're invading their privacy?
Yeah,
and when I'm on my Facebook page ads show up on the right-hand side that related to anything that I look for in Google.
Yeah. and so
that makes me, at first that made me nervous, but then I started playing with it. You know, I would put notes in my Facebook saying, you know, kippers, beer, cats, horses, and just see what would show up on my Facebook. But Facebook knew better. They knew I was playing with them. They kept going back to the ads of the things that I would look for.
So they're controlled for that, yeah.
Right. So the question, nonprofits are just not that savvy in big data. Nonprofits have not made it to the as far as Target has made it in grasping, you know, the how to pick up all of the ways in which you communicate with the world and looking at you as a pattern. We just don't have.
I think that's a great point. And I think there's so much talk about data, big data and small data and all different kinds. What's your take on whether, what's your experience on whether nonprofits have made the most of the existing little, you know, normal data that they've got before they start going out into all this, you know, whole universe of different data points that they can purchase from different vendors and things like that?
Right. Well, I think that, I mean, I'm always a big fan of exploiting what you already know.
Yeah.
And so one thing we already know is that gift data is audited. In the United States, your gift data has to pass an accounting audit. I'm sure there's something similar in the UK for donors, but and once you can look at your own stuff, though, at some point you hit a threshold where you say, we're only looking at Cornellians from a Cornell point of view. We're not looking at Cornellians from the point of view of their own interests.
Yeah,
and so
sure.
We automatically ask an engineering graduate to give to engineering, ignoring entirely that he's had a subscription to the hockey games for the last 15 years.
Sure.
Because we don't know, or we're not looking at them that way.
Yeah, right.
So that's where that's where big data plays a bigger role. We're talking now about how do we look at people from their viewpoint instead of from ours.
Yeah, that's right. And do you see it in that case as being a challenge of integrating all the, really being targeted, I guess, because there's so much different, there's so many different insights that it's possible to get using whichever type of data that you're using, whichever system you're using, whichever tool, how difficult is it then to be targeted just to what you need to do and what actually matters for your organization rather than being chased off into, you know, a side project or a kind of cul-de-sac? Is that a challenge for organizations?
Yes, and so I think that the first thing that I have to do is I have to figure out the question I'm going to answer. Mm. Then I have to figure out who my audience is because I have to communicate with them in their terms,
sure.
And then I need to get a deadline. And I'm a Kaizen approach person. I love the incremental improvement.
Even
our alumni survey brought out lots and lots of pieces of information about how our alumni communicate with us and how they feel connected. We actually asked them, how connected do you feel?
Mm-hmm.
And we used a lot of that. Our alumni affairs office went right to work on that, to make good use of it. And at the same time, we continue to go forward with the core question. What are they telling us in their answers?
Sure.
So I try not to use more than one new tool at a time. So for the survey project, the new tool I was using was text analytics.
Okay, sure.
I try to make sure that I test everything so that when I present it, it's sound and it can be easily demonstrated and, it makes sense to the audience.
Yeah, sure. Makes sense.
Once I do that, and for me, it's the making the presentation or writing the white paper that gives me the place where I can say, okay, I stop here and I completed something.
Yeah. Go on. I interrupted.
Okay. And then that's when the audience comes back and says, that was very exciting. Can you do this more?
Sure. So it's a natural kind of point when you're writing the white paper or the presentation slides. At that point, you're summing up and then you're going to present. And then it's kind of this iteration, I guess, where the audience comes back and says, well, that was good, but can you try this? And that's quite a natural process, I guess.
Yes, yes. And, of course, you know that the biggest compliment when you're at work is for someone to ask you for something else.
Yeah, sure. And not just take it.
Yes, they skip the part where they tell you that was very good work, and they say, can you add this other thing? And that's their way of saying they're very excited. Yeah.
That's how you know you've really hit on me.
I think the other piece that we get and the communication piece is not only communicating results, but it's also understanding what the need really is and translating what somebody is saying to you about their job and how frustrated they are with one thing or another into specific data steps.
Yeah.
Often people will see me drawing big pictures of things out on the whiteboards and trying to figure out what it is we're all trying to say.
Yeah.
And at some point we come to a connection where I feel I can, I have access to the data, and I can get some of the answer, and they feel I understood what they're looking for.
And how much of that is actually just bringing things back? Like, how much of it is actually just going back to, well, why are we doing this? What's the purpose? Mm-hmm. You know, coming back to that. Is that an important part of that process?
Yes, and I mean, I'm very client-oriented, so I wouldn't, mm-hmm. I want very much to encourage my clients to ask for help and to ask for more and to ask for information. And so the why are we doing that has to be couched in terms of, you know, help me understand where we want to get to. Mm. And then it makes it easier for them to feel comfortable that they can ask me for the help.
Yeah, I guess that's an intuitive thing. Can you just give us an insight into the types of tools that you're using at the minute at Cornell? I know there's a tool called Tableau, which is spoken of quite a lot for using for lots of different things. Are there any other kind of... Yeah.
Sorry, we actually have the early adopters of Tableau Server at Cornell. Cornell was one of the earlier adopters.
Right.
So that's a visualization piece, and that's the piece where I can show the story to the audience. Yeah. And if they say, what about, Tableau is brilliant at, if somebody says, well, what about class year, we can move class year into the display and answer their questions and answer why we didn't consider class year as most important, that sort of thing. The other tool I'm using for the straight-up analytics is SPSS, with just about all of the modules. Mm-hmm. And then we're using Node Excel for the project I was describing. Mm-hmm. And I'm learning, I learned a little bit of Perl, but I'm learning Python now for data management. So if I'm going to go out and I'm going to try to pick up, I don't know, we have to name our political donations. If I'm going to go out and try to pick those up, Python will do that. And I have someone on my team who's an expert at that anyway. Mm-hmm. He can watch Twitter feeds, or we bought the hedge fund advisory forms from the Securities and Exchange Commission, and we scraped it. So, So those are the tools that I'm using now. And for me, I get called on it, but for me, the thing is that I want to learn something new all the time.
Yeah, so restless and trying to kind of find out new tools and new ways to use them all the time. That's an interesting thing. And where would you look for new things coming through? So not necessarily for procuring new products, but for learning of new products. Do you have sources that you would use very often on the web, or do you speak to people, or is it conferences, or how would you do that?
It's actually I'm what's called a puller. I pull data. If I want something, I'll go look for it. There are some people who are pushers. They prefer information be sent to them. So, so I will go all over the web, and I will go talk to different people, or I'll put it up on the DMM list for people who have already done it. Yeah. I tend to lean a little bit too much toward trying it too long myself before I ask for help. But that's because I love
So, so it's a combination of things. And that, but the list that you mentioned was really interesting. Do you want to just say a bit about the sort of being on the Prospect DMM list and sort of what role that, because people in the UK, there'll be some people who signed up, I'm sure, but most of the people on that list will actually be based US side and based over there. So
there was a small group of us who was led by Rob Scott, who is the director of individual giving at MIT now. He got a small group of us on the phone one day and said, we need a group of our own. We need a place of our own to talk about analytics. And that we founded that group and also founded the conference that is now the DMM conference or the symposium that APRA hosts. It was about getting to a place where we had access to someone who could come back to us and say, yes, I already tried this and this is what I got.
So it was about sharing experiences to begin with, and then it's grown since then?
Yes, and the wonder of nonprofit fundraising is that we're not competitive. We don't have competitive intelligence problems in the way that my for-profit partners would have.
Yeah, I think it's the same in the UK as well. People are very willing to share. The climate is different, I think, from the commercial sector. So I think that's a real positive. It's a really nice thing about working for charities, I think, is that people are willing to share and exchange tips and speak about what's worked and what's not worked as well, to a certain extent, right?
Right. And that's the nice part. I mean, we assume that we do not share prospects.
Yeah.
But of course, we know we do.
That's true. I mean, it's true. And the typical, that goes back to the retention point where, typically, I'm not sure how it is in the US, but in the UK, people will typically support two or three charities. It could be more than that, but the average supporter will be supporting more than one charity at the same time. And that's not including universities and alma mater and places like that. So that's why the survey methodology and asking for people's feedback is so important, I think, because they're the best people to interpret that. You know, they experience these supporter journeys multiple times a week, a month, never mind a year. So they'll be speaking from experience, and that's why it's so important to internalize that for organizations and bring it back inside.
Well, also, if I understand correctly, in the UK, the culture is I cannot just walk up to you and ask you, will you consider a £1,000 gift to your university. I actually have to build a comfort level with you, and even then, I have to be very thoughtful about my ask.
Yeah, I think the asks, again, I don't know what it would be like from the US side. I think direct marketing is one of the major channels for charities in this country. So, and that could be mail-based, it could be letters coming to your home, it could be face-to-face. So we have street fundraisers who will actually ask you for money in the street. Television panels on trains and things like this, other methods. That would typically be for low value, between sort of £3, a regular gift of £3 per month, and then going up to something like £15 or £20 per month on the regular side. I think on the cash side it could be higher than that, but that would be a lot of people's experience of being asked for funds from a charity. I think for major support, you would get into certainly building up the relationship. There'd be face-to-face contacts, which I guess would be quite similar to the US side on the philanthropy
We
side.
do spend less time building the relationship and the comfort, and the way that we ask is very direct.
Right. Yeah. So
Yes.
I previously worked for a US organization, my last job, and they would have a black tie dinner, and each one of these dinners would be at the end was an ask. So they would always ask for support. Every single event, there was not one event that did not feature an ask, and it was very direct. So people would stand up and say, "We need your help. You know, we need your support."
Yes, and what little I understand, Helen Brown has tried to teach me some, but is that we're faster about it, we're much more direct about it, and can almost feel commercial,
Right.
the way that we do it in relation. So the study that I the work that I did in understanding UK fundraising is you ask a lot more survey questions than we do. We ask for the gift first, and then we ask who you are. And yeah,
It's
and you seem to have it much better in that. You're not going to lose the relationship as quickly as we might.
I don't know about that. I think that that's why I was referring to retention and building relationships before, because there's still, even though we do build relationships with supporters, there are still issues around this balance and the tension between acquiring a new supporter and actually going on and then keeping that person engaged for a long time. And there are still issues with kind of people committing one or two gifts and then moving on to another organization, because it's a crowded marketplace. There are lots of people asking for support at any one time. So I think the consumers and supporters are cognizant of that, and that's an issue, which I guess would be the same there, right?
Yes, well, one of the issues in fundraising is that many of you steward someone at a certain level, and you cannot drop it. So even if my next year's gift is $10, you still have to steward me as though I'm still giving 1,000. And so until I come back up again.
Sure.
So that's the hard part. Or if I commit to 500 euros, and the next year when you go to ask me to repeat that, you don't ask me in the same personal way that you did last year,
Sure.
then I'm not going to respond well. And so we have to be very thoughtful about our human resources, who gets a phone call from a person, who just gets direct mail, who just gets a text, that sort of thing. And
Yeah.
analytics plays a very good role in that,
How
and
do
helps
you
to, go ahead.
help then in from the analytical side to kind of to give a steer as to who actually should receive which treatment? Is that a big part of what you spend your time on, presenting that
Yes.
information?
Yes, because the fundraising method and who it works best on is important to us. And example I have is when I was at Carnegie Mellon, one of the things we discovered empirically was that engineering prospects preferred really to be solicited by email and not to be visited in person.
Interesting.
as generally as a group. Of course, there's going to be one or two people who are a comfortable exception. So people would be asking for a $100,000 five-year gift from an engineering grad by email and sending them the case statement.
Wow.
And it feels sacrilegious, you know.
Well,
but it was... Go ahead.
We've had experiences as well. Yeah, I personally have had experiences working on this area, which might be of interest in the US as well, which is kind of referred to as mid-value. So in between direct mail and then, but not quite philanthropic level giving. I've had experiences of gifts in the tens of thousands of pounds solicited by mail. So it's, it does happen, as you say, but it's, I don't know if that's quite the normal thing. I'm not sure if that's for everyone, but maybe, maybe it's about the target.
Yes, and we used to make the assumption that at your a certain level, you wanted to be treated a certain way,
right.
And you had to earn your way up there. So one of the things that I say when I, at the organization where I volunteer, they're always asking me to go to events, but events make me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I'm not good at small talk. I'm busy counting how many people have glasses and you know, paying attention to the food, and it's hard for me to make small talk, and it doesn't make me feel special. It makes me feel like I'm working. Because I'm introverted. And I tell them that. Thank you for the invitation. I know that you're thinking of me. I know that you think that I'm special. And I won't be going. I actually feel more engaged with them when I'm sitting with them in their office trying to figure out how to manage their database.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Right. And so actually it comes back to one of the things we were talking about on my team is we have people who come to events and they're engaged. And we think of coming to events as an engagement technique. But then there are people who are involved in virtual communities on Facebook or Twitter where they're still talking about Cornell. They still love Cornell. But they don't want to get in a tuxedo and drive someplace, you know, away from their comfortable man cave or whatever and, you know, stand around with strangers.
Mm.
They want to talk about their Cornell experience and can you believe that basketball team did that again and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So you're aware of that and Cornell's aware of that because that's a really interesting difference because you could... I mean, you could easily then move into solicitation, as you say, for major support on the philanthropic side, but that's completely against the traditional idea of how that would work.
Right, right. And the way that I think of the donor's journey, as you described, we call it the prospect ladder, but I like donor's journey because that actually allows one to go up and down, is that as I start, where am I starting and then where do I go from there? Mm. So I see the whole thing as a huge flow chart.
Yes, yes.
Instead of us trying to get someone to move along a straight line.
Well, how do you, let me ask you then, at Cornell, how do you conceptualize the donor journey in that case? Because the traditional idea from my experience is quite a linear thing. It's a step process. It's 1 to 5, it's 1 to 7, something like that. But you start at the beginning, you go through the middle, and then you finish up at the end, and then you go around again. Whereas the actual experience, as we've said, the experience is completely different to that. And I'm just wondering how you, are you able in your work to recognize that, or is it still along this quite linear sort of process?
Well, and that's an excellent question. Bobby Strand talked about this 15 years ago or 20 years ago, where you have people that you just ask them to give and renew and give and renew, and then you have people that you're asking them for at 100,000 and better.
Yeah.
And you're forgetting all those people in the middle who are the bread and butter of your unrestricted money.
Mm.
So we see that, and actually we started a leadership giving program, again, to recognize that there are people whose capacity is not at the higher philanthropic level, but their interest is enough that we can ask them to write a check for $25,000 in a given year, as provided we ask them correctly. You know, we get on the phone with them, we talk to them about their experience, and then we make the ask.
Is that in terms of tracking that information, kind of mapping it along this kind of step process, is that familiar to you? Would you use a similar process to that, or is there some other way that you would track a relationship?
Actually, there is a there was a white paper that I read some time ago, and I still would like to do it using what they call hidden Markov modeling, where if you ask me for a gift, I have a probability of giving the gift, I have a probability of not giving the gift, and I have a probability of never receiving your ask.
Sure.
Right. And so then we have to figure out what the probability is. And if you invite me to an event, do I go back in my relationship or forward in my relationship in response to the invitation and then in response to attending? And so in that way, I'm describing the movement of a person forward or backwards, and what happens then.
Right, so that's a way of conceptualizing the donor relationship, really, through quite a formulaic, not formulaic, mm-hmm. but kind of quite a specific method, I suppose, rather than just making a judgment call about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You're looking at a more rigorous methodology than that.
Right, because we assume that people want to give, and then if they give again, they want to give a third time, and then they want to get up to 1,000 so they can get on the donor, the special donor list, and get acknowledgement and recognition. Mm-hmm. And we're doing that without asking them how they feel.
Yeah, and there's also this kind of overlay of what's really an arbitrary construct of the financial year, right? So we have targets. All organizations need to bring in income.
Yes.
They hold themselves to account through financial years, but this
Yes.
doesn't take any account of people's ability to give or their connection or what's going on with their life at all. It's just, it's nothing to do with the donor at all.
Well, a study I did when I was in my MBA program was, when did people have the most amount of cash? And so, and you know, in the United States, we measure ourselves like crazy. we don't have the kind of privacy protections that you have. So I actually went to the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and I downloaded information about when people had the most disposable income. And it did turn out to be October, November, December. January, February would be slight, and then would pick up again in March. And so our fundraising cycle was perfect. But I agree with you. We always set our fundraising cycles up for our convenience and not for the donors.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so when I was running the annual fund, in 97, I had an accounting student as my grad assistant running our phone-a-thon, and she said she wanted to call all of our accounting graduates in September and October because after that we would never be able to reach them. And that year we saw a 50% increase in fundraising results.
Oh, really?
Yes, and so that's the piece that you're saying. You know, we are trying to figure out how to set up listening devices, and now we have to interpret what we're hearing, and we have to interpret it through the filters that make us hear what people are saying to us, not through the filters that make us look for the things that we want.
Yeah, it strikes me that good, successful organizations really internalize that stuff, and they keep on doing that. They don't just do it once and then that's job done, but they will, you know, from month to month, even and quarter to quarter, they'll keep on doing this, trying to listen, and then also disseminating that internally and repeat, you know, go back and do it again.
Right. And the surprise for us, at nonprofits, there's no reward for increasing your results. You just get your standard raise. You know, you might get a merit raise, but it's not the same as in for-profits where you get significant remuneration or remuneration. You get significant money for doing well. And so those people have much more interest and energy in changing their routines in order to get success.
Yeah.
In fundraising, we resist change because there's not a lot in it for us.
That's true.
Right. And leading change is a slow process. And also, I work in an academic environment. And in an academic environment, to change the culture, a whole lot of committees have to meet and talk about it and ruminate on it and, you know, like they're doing some kind of research project on the economy.
Yeah, I think it's similar over here as well, especially because some of the universities are long-standing, you know, so they're long, long established, and it's like that analogy of turning the oil tanker around the corner. It can really take quite a lot of effort and time to do that.
Yes, 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 because this is our tradition, and this tradition has lasted us. I mean, for us, we would say 200 years, but for you, it would be 600, 700, right, or 1,000.
Yes. It's lots of time, so getting that change is really difficult sometimes. Let me ask you, because I'm aware of time, so I don't want to keep you for too long, but just the final question is about sort of information sources and data sources and things like that. So there's never been as much open data. There's never been as many huge data sets out there. So are there good sources of data that you use regularly that you could direct people to and that you would flag up as being good resources to use?
Mm-hmm. So if I were looking for external data, we will buy credit data. But if I had my perfect data, it would be, what does somebody like to do? So it would be something like, what kind of magazines do they subscribe to? Because it would tell me where their passion is.
Yeah.
Not necessarily how do they spend their money, but how do they spend their time.
Sure. So what's their motivation? What's their psychological interest? Yeah.
Right. And so we've done very well with things like, we've used screening products. So we have some screening data and philanthropic giving, but we're still looking for free resources right now as we build our program. We've done the Forbes top zip codes for, I know, Canadian postal codes. There's certain pieces of a Canadian postal code that will tell you something about where they are, even what side of the street they're on. And I don't know if England is like that as well.
Yeah, the that's how the yeah, you can get that information from the start of the code. So it's that will tell you the kind of the region, and then it's split down within the code as to I don't know about the side of the street, but it's you can have maps of postcode regions, and then you can kind of pinpoint where the actual postcode is. But the first part will refer to the actual region.
So if you had the opportunity to take that postal region and your real estate values from that postal region, you would have some estimate of wealth, and you'd be able to find a volunteer in those neighborhoods and to say, you know, can you have a reception, if that's the sort of thing that works well.
I think that's interesting. I'm speaking to Helen Brown later on today, actually, for this series, and I actually wrote a blog post for her a couple of weeks ago now, because there's a proposal in this country to perhaps look at a mansion tax. So the higher value properties, there could be some tax associated with that after the election next year. And that would be a government data source. So you would have this for top properties. You'd have a government open data set, which would be what you're describing.
So a couple. I mean, there's going to be a couple of considerations with that. The first is that isn't property at that level of wealth handed down from father to son? Is that still true?
Well, it can be inherited for sure, but this is looking more at current valuation rather than the right of tenure, I guess. So
and of course, it also reminds me when I was studying in history class that the last time a tax like that went out, it was the size of your roof. So all these mansions got ruined because people were ripping their roofs off. So I don't know how that would work out.
Watch this space. Watch this space after the election. well, Marianne, thank you so much for talking. It's been incredibly insightful. Yeah. I've really enjoyed it. And
thank you for putting my brain to work. I appreciate it.
That's great. So we're going to be, these are going to be podcasted out there in association with the IOF. So we'll get those out early next year. And I'm sure there'll be questions after that point, people eager to ask and follow up and that kind of thing. Once again, thank you for talking. I really appreciate it. And we'll be in touch when it's being posted.
Okay, great. Have a great evening.
You too. Thanks so much, Marianne. Take care. Thank you.